be one, we're working with them in a compassionate way, in a transparent way, in a helpful way. When we give them options, we usually give three options to the homeowner. So then that way they can have some empowerment and they can choose. And so how we look at it is if we ever, you know, ran into litigation with one of the mortgage notes, we can go before a judge and say, hey, look, this is the chain of communication. And in every aspect of the communication, you know, we've been compassionate. We've been trying to be helpful and work with the homeowner to help them stay in their home.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Martin Sines brings social good into smart investing. He is a managed partner of Bequest Funds, and he's also renowned as a thought leader in the mortgage note investment industry. Martin is also passionate about creating a better world through a profitable business, and he works hard to share and spread his success. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Sam.
Hey, the pleasure's mine. The same three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. Can you quickly tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, I started with reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad in 2004 after leaving a corporate job and figuring out what to do next. And so that was the starting point. Went into small business ownership as the first step, if you will. Where we are now is I operate a hedge fund that has about $35 million in there with that assets under management. It's privately held with my partner and I. And we also have a $50 million income fund that's 506C Reg D. So we entertain accredited investors into that income fund. And I have a portfolio of commercial and residential properties that I self-manage.
Wow. You got a lot of things going on there. I mean, the transition from small business to running a hedge fund. Can you give us some just quick intermediate steps on that and how you got to where you are now?
Yeah, I think, you know, when at the starting point in 2004, 2005, the end game was always to build passive income in my own life and my family's lives. And so what was interesting is I went into small business ownership because that was almost the guidance, right? You need to have ongoing cash flow in order to have money to invest into real estate and start building portfolio of buy and hold properties. So we did that. We founded, my wife and I founded a government contracting company where we sold goods and services to the federal government. And in course of doing so, we ended up purchasing a building that we operated the company out of in 2009. Then we bought the neighboring building a month later, and then we just started buying more property. However, what I realized is the property play was great and it did spit off some passive income, but it didn't meet my financial aspirations. And we sold the company, the federal contracting company in 13, and I found mortgage note investing at that time and the clouds parted at that point.
That's fantastic. What and how did you go? So once you got into mortgage note investing, a lot of people will get in and they'll start buying, you know, onesie, twosie, notes, you know, one-offs, but
yes,
you've taken this to a very institutional level. So what was that iterations or how did those iterations play out?
Yes. Yeah, so it started off, I'd say slow. I bought 10 mortgage notes out of the gate, not knowing what I was doing. So it started with being low on the learning curve and taking a lot of lessons financially, as well as physically, getting the operation off the ground. I did it with my own money. So that's the good news to it all. And just kind of stuck to it. And what I realized is that I realized two things, that for one, my objective with mortgage note investing was to build long-term streams of income for myself. So I had to do that by purchasing distressed mortgage paper at discounts from lending institutions and other hedge funds. And I had to work close with the borrower, whoever that was, to create payment plans, i.e. loan modifications, to help them remain in their homes. In doing so, I would create 20, 30-year streams of income. And it would help not displace individuals, which was very key. That was the first lesson. The other one was I had to build systems out. So I took inventory of every new task I was doing, and I organized it later and built out SOPs right from the very beginning, which kind of helped me reach scalability at a later point.
Right. That's really fascinating. Now, it's my understanding that you can't service your own notes. Did you open two separate companies or how does that work?
So for the most part, we use a licensed servicer to collect our payments, send out monthly statements and year-end tax forms and so forth. However, it's really on a state-by-state basis. There are some states that require servicing licensing. There's some states that require mortgage lender licensing, some that require no licensing. So it's really on a state-by-state basis in terms of what you can and cannot do. But we do use a licensed servicer. It just makes it easier.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, I was really just thinking about early on how you were able to kind of figure those parts of this out. You know, compliance. Let's talk a little bit about that. This is one of those things that, you know, it just, I mean, for those of us raising money, which you're dealing with this on two fronts, right? You're raising money for your fund, which is a compliance nightmare in and of itself, I would say. And then you're also dealing with compliance on loan servicing, on mortgages and moratoriums and I mean, there's a lot to keep up with there. Talk to us about that, the challenges your industry faces and how you guys work around that.
Yeah. So it's a very tough time to be a mortgage note investor on the mom and pop level because you really need in-house compliance efforts as well as, you know, using outside counsel as needed to ensure you're in compliance, you know, within each state that you operate in. And so that's kind of first and foremost. It wasn't like that when I first started in 2013. There was a lot less compliance, a lot less restrictions. So, but to operate in today's world, you do need to have a whole operation, you know, supporting your efforts on compliance, but also on the collateral review. There's a lot with statute of limitations. There's a lot of other restrictions that could really, you know, catch someone in this business badly if they don't adhere to certain aspects during the underwriting phase of acquisitions.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Talk to us about the moratoriums. How did that affect the note servicing side?
Yes. So on our hedge fund, we buy a lot of distressed mortgage debt. So these are mortgages that are bank originated and the homeowner, for some reason, stopped paying at some period in time. And now they're in a delinquent state. Most likely, you know, it's due to a divorce or some health occurrence or that are lost a job that results in defaulted state because, you know, these are good borrowers. You know, they got a good rate. They got, you know, from a major lending institution at some point. And so with that said, you know, we're buying these in at discounts and we're working with the homeowner in a compassionate way to figure out what they can pay now and to help them remain in their home. But with that said, you know, we have to be mindful in terms of what we can and cannot do from an asset management perspective. We use a licensed servicer to make sure that we cover a lot of the licensing requirements we have on a state-by-state basis. But at the end of the day, we hold a mantra within our company to treat the homeowner like gold and, you know, have every action towards the homeowner be one, we're working with them in a compassionate way, in a transparent way, in a helpful way. When we give them options, we usually give three options to the homeowner. So then that way they can have some empowerment and they can choose. And so how we look at it is if we ever, you know, ran into litigation with one of the mortgage notes, we can go before a judge and say, hey, look, this is the chain of communication. And in every aspect of the communication, you know, we've been compassionate. We've been trying to be helpful and work with the homeowner to help them stay in their home.
In the end, I would imagine it's best for both parties. I mean, because if you keep a borrower in there, you turn a, you know, a non-paying borrower into a reperforming note. And it's like, oh, wait, I mean, that's good for you. And it's also good for them. I mean, it's less expensive for you than turning it into a foreclosure or something else. And I mean, it's better for them because they have to stay in their house. Why do banks, why do they, or whoever it is that's selling these notes, why do they sell them as distressed as opposed to just foreclosing on the property and going that route?
Yeah, let me give the second part because I didn't fully answer your question regarding the moratorium because I was kind of leading up to it.
Please.
Yeah, so the whole idea is to build deep-rooted relationships with these homeowners so that there's, you know, there's a level of communication and respect that's going on in the relationship. And so with that said, that's no different than tenant-landlord relationships. You know, the better your relationship is with the tenants, the more they're going to pay on time, the more that they're going to communicate if they had some life occurrence that is catching them the wrong way and so on. So you can plan accordingly as a landlord. And so what we found is going into COVID and having these moratoriums issued is we found that we refined our approach with the homeowner and that we were doing more outreach, doing more being more compassionate, being more, you know, understanding in terms of what people's situations were. So we kind of escalated our level of compassion. We enhanced our KPIs, key performance indicators. So whereas we were looking at certain metrics on a weekly basis, we started looking at it on a daily basis. So we professionalized our whole, you know, our whole metrics control approach. And we learned what we can and could not do, what we could and could not do on a state-by-state basis based on moratoriums in place. But we actually go try to minimize our legal effort anyway, because we try to just focus on the relationship aspect of it. As far as buying paper, why a lender sells the paper is, you know, they're good at one thing, and that's taking deposits in and lending out money. And they really don't want to be stuck with toxic assets on their books for very long. Obviously, I can't speak to, you know, internal bank operations, but I know they're doing charge-offs and they're doing, you know, other reworking of, you know, line items and et cetera, you know, amongst themselves. But at some point, they get to the point where they're like, well, let's just liquidate this pool of defaulted paper. Sometimes it's just a PR for PR reasons. They don't want to be start foreclosure on a pool of mortgages, you know, given COVID or given whatever time period we're in. There's always some political time period that we're in where it's not advantageous to start foreclosure on a, you know, on a bulk of your defaulted paper. So they sell it off and they cut bait and sell it to a hedge fund. What's interesting in our space now is, and this also goes hand in hand to why it's hard for the mom and pops right now operating. And I was a mom and pop for a while, so I get that, is because hedge funds and other lending institutions are much more selective now who they sell to. There's a whole risk factor. If they sell it to someone that doesn't know how to underwrite these loans, doesn't know how to perform asset management, you know, within compliance, doesn't know how to be in compliance in general, I mean, you know, that could have repercussions to the seller of that paper. So it bodes well for the people that, you know, have their game tight, if you will.
Right. Yeah. I've commonly heard that the last quarter of the year is kind of the selling or buying season, if you will, in the mortgage note industry. Yet, you know, we were talking kind of off air here and you were saying that there's right now there's still some deal flow constraints. Is that just on the distressed side or is that just across the board?
Yeah. So we've been actively purchasing. It's really on. And I think everything that I'm mentioning here, anybody in the real estate side can relate to this. You know, this whole mom and pop, scalability, systems, relationship building with your tenants. I mean, this is all, you know, applicable on that other side of the coin. And so what's happened is there has been a lot less deal flow trickling down to the mom and pop levels of note investors, because what's happening is two things. You know, we have property valuation spikes across the country. We have, you know, historically low interest rates. So people are refinancing out this debt, whether it's on the performing side or non-performing side at record levels. So hedge funds are just holding on to this paper and they're getting really, you know, favorable workouts as a result on this paper. So they're not as inclined to do any reselling, even if they purchase some of the pool outside their buy box. And so they're holding on to this paper. So now, in terms of, yeah, so there's deal flow constraints on the mom and pop level, not as much on the mid-market level, if you will.
Gotcha. What have been some challenges for you as you have scaled your business?
Yeah, so I think we learned early on, we have a team of 14 individuals here that work for us. We learned early on that we really had to train a lot of individuals. So because you want people with good habits, you want people to do things the way that you believe is the best way. Obviously, we want collaboration, but at the end of the day, we feel like we have a very good system in place. We feel like we feel very, you know, aligned with our motto of helping the homeowner stay in their homes and, you know, all these other things that create a good social good. So we want to hire people that we can, that have, you know, integrity, that have compassion, that are hardworking, and then we can train them on the rest. So with that said, we need to have training manuals. We need to have SOPs. We need to be organized so we can bring people in and train them in a consistent, efficient manner.
Yeah. And that's the challenge of every business, I think, is getting that lined out. I mean, without it, it's just 10 times harder. So that's absolutely wonderful. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
Martin, let's jump here into the final four questions. What is one tool or resource you find you can't live without?
I'd say my laptop. I do a lot of, I'd say my personal financial statement or my overall financial statement. So I keep that up to date. I look at all my accounts on a daily basis. I try to keep focused. And I did that when I didn't have any money. And it was just kind of a good habit, looking over all my financials, the good, bad, and ugly. And I do recommend anyone do that, even if they don't have any money or they haven't nearly met their aspirations. They should be aware of where they are at any given time financially, because that you want to just kind of start building that mindset.
Right. No, I love that. I love that. If you could help our listeners avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Yeah. You know, avoid investing just for appreciation. I see that so much, and there's so much emotion behind it. And I know there's a whole wealth effect going on in the country. Everyone feels wealthy because, you know, property valuations are inflated and the true inflationary numbers are hidden. So right. I get it. Like, everyone's feeling really good, but this isn't going to last. And one should always focus on cash flow. So what is coming into your bank account on a monthly basis in a consistent manner? So think of investing in terms of that.
Right. I love that. I love that. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're helping homeowners avoid losing their home. That's first and foremost. But right. on the BeQuest fund side, it's an income fund whereby we bring on investors and they get to participate in the profits and all the good that we're doing. We only buy seasoned performing mortgages in that fund. So it's a very conservative fund. Mm. And it pays out, you know, 9% annually, and we make our payments to our investors on a monthly basis. So that's, I think, cool. We're doing a good thing for our investors.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's fantastic. Wonderful. Martin, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, learn more about you or any of your funds, how do they do that?
Yes. So they can send me an email at martin@bqfunds.com. It's martin@bqfunds.com. And it doesn't even have to be an investment related question. If you just have a question on the mortgage industry in general, you know, I'd be more than happy to answer anybody who has questions.
Martin, thank you so much for your time today. Learned a lot about what you guys do. This was really fascinating just hearing how you've grown your business. You know, learned a lot about the mortgage note industry. Yeah, man, this is fantastic. So thank you again. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, Sam, keep up the good work.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.